accession number 19392, reel 2.
Donald Evans, reel 2.
You said, should we be lenient or severe? I don't think that was a question that was ever posed. I think the overriding thing is that you should be just, or attempt to be just. The general advice was that you should be friendly and responsive in general, but in times of stress or where the circumstances required it, you should be distant and severe and, I suppose, autocratic. Well, that is almost a function of leadership, isn't it? That when the time comes, you say, there's no argument, this is what we do. So I think the advice or the instruction we got was a sensible blend between being so standoffish that the troops felt they could never approach you and began to dislike you, and an excessive familiarity which would undermine your authority.
What is wet bridging?
Wet bridging is... to start off with, more basically, is dry bridging. There's a gap, either a river or whatever, chasm of some sort, that you have to cross, and you can get to both banks, and the bridge generally, this would be a Bailey bridge, it would span from one bank to the other, irrespective of what was in between. Wet bridging is where the river is too wide to cross in one span for the load that you're carrying, and therefore you float one end of the Bailey span onto a pontoon. The next span goes onto another pontoon. They butt together and join up so that it is the bridge is effectively floating on pontoons across, and of course the pontoons have to be anchored so they don't float away. That's one. That's, I think, calling class 40 or something like that. I think they went higher than that. I don't think I ever dealt with anything above class 40, which would take the sort of armour we were using. The other bridge, as I said, is a class 9, which is folding boat equipment, which, as its name implies, is a boat that you pull up the sides, prop them out, so that you've got, in fact, a sort of huge canoe thing, and there are beams between these, and they button onto the gunwales of these pontoons and make this flexible bridge. That is for soft vehicles, you know, 3-ton lorries, jeeps, that sort of thing. Quite quick.
What, for those who don't know, is a pontoon?
Pardon?
What, for those who do not know, is a pontoon?
A pontoon, the pontoons that we used were in three parts, like Gaul. The centre part was a rectangle, and the other two parts were rectangles with one end made into a bow, so that they... so that they rode in the river. In other words, they didn't form a block to the river like at the bow of a boat. You assemble these. How big were they, you will ask me, and I'm damned if I can tell you now, but I suppose they must have been about 20 feet long by about 4 feet high by about 6 or 7 or 8 feet wide. In other words, just a box.
Made of?
Timber, I think.
So they flirted.
Oh, which says they flirted. Well, they were like ships. You see, they were like boats, and you button these three together, and you got a floating ship, really, three boxes length, and the Bailey's span landed on this, and the next one landed on the next one. You buttoned them together.
Were they secured to the riverbed?
Oh, yes, that's what I say. You had to secure them to the riverbed with anchors or ropes to the bank or whatever to stop them drifting down, because you had to keep them in line, otherwise the bridge would deform. The other thing you could do with pontoons is miss out the middle bit so that you had two bow sections together. One end was a square end with a vertical face. The other was a bow-shaped piece. You brought the two square bits together. You had another one beside it, and with Bailey bridging panels and transoms and deck beams and so forth, you made a raft, and you could ferry armor or indeed soft vehicles across a river. By putting outboard motors and making this as a boat. In other words, there are two parallel hulls with a centerpiece of Bailey bridging across the top, and the vehicles, whatever you wanted, was sitting between the panels, and you took it across with outboard motors. I think they were mostly 22 horsepower Seagull motors. Took them across, ran the thing at right angles so that the hulls were parallel to the riverbank, and you had a ramp and ran the vehicles off onto the other side.
Did you use the term Engels Bridge earlier?
Yes, that was Engels, named after Sir Claude Engels, who invented it. That was a cumbersome thing. It was on its way out, and we only did it as an exercise. It was never used it in real life.
So it was replaced by the Bailey Bridge.
Pardon?
It was replaced by the Bailey Bridge.
Replaced by the Bailey Bridge, that's right. Infinitely more flexible and usable.
Did you have any particular likes or dislikes in the different types of work that you were learning?
I had a strong dislike of carrying ammunition boxes full of soil up hills. But apart from that, no, I think maybe time lends enchantment to these things, but it was all very interesting. You felt that you were actually learning something that was going to be useful. Some things it was quite unpleasant, like struggling with barbed wire, laying out barbed wire, which was, of course, an essential thing later on, but humping this stuff about was fairly unpleasant.
Because of tearing your...
Yeah, that's right. So, I'm sure there were lots of things you didn't like at all, but they don't readily come back to mind, and it may be that time has put a roseate glow over the whole thing.
What did you feel as somebody who'd been learning civil engineering about the way the army approached engineering?
Well, you must remember, I was a pretty still pretty green as a civil engineer. The other thing, of course, is that it was dealing with a very different range of problems to which one would to those which one would face as a civil engineer, purely civil. For example, there was a great deal of emphasis on the military side of things, as exemplified by infantry tactics. Well, you certainly didn't get that in civil engineering. And there was a necessity to produce ad hoc solutions, whereas if one was in an office and doing it with a drawing board and calculating machines and so forth, you would probably produce a solution of such and such. On the field, you looked round, what was there to use? We had to get over it. had to tackle the problem with what you'd got. So you had to improvise. And the fact is, of course, that you cut factors of safety down because the necessity was speed and flexibility rather than safety and long-term durability. So that was the essential difference.
Now, you're out in Clanberis and Newark. Mm-hmm. What are your next memories, please?
We then went to Halifax. I was commissioned in Newark. Went to Halifax as newly commissioned second lieutenants, and we were then shipped to India on a ship called the Multan, if I remember rightly.
What was the voyage like?
It was long. I'm glad to say it was boring and comfortable, because we went in a huge convoy, and being a troop convoy as opposed to a material convoy, I'm quite sure that the Navy had a very high level of escorts. In other words, I think on troop convoys, they didn't spare the escorts, whereas on other convoys, it might be that the shortage of escorts reflected on their ability to protect the convoy. I don't remember any of our ships being sunk in the convoy. The thing that it struck me, coming from wartime Britain, going on to this P&O, was the luxury. We went down, sat down in the saloon. We had meals served by the stewards. Good meals, silver, good china. My recollection was there wasn't much drink, which was probably a sensible thing, but I think we had tickets that we could use as we wanted, but that was about all.
Tickets?
Coupons for drink. I'm not sure if it wasn't dry. Certainly drink doesn't enter into my consciousness, either being present or not present. I can't believe it was totally dry, and I think we had coupons that we could use, but my memory is confused on that. What I do remember was that the style of the meals was a pre-war style, and we had a cabin, two officers to a cabin. So it was quite luxurious in that respect.
So this was a pre-war liner?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Actually, I think she was at the end of her life, but...
And where did you arrive in India?
Bombay.
What were your impressions of Bombay?
It's difficult now, because I've been in India so much since, to distinguish between my overall view of India and what it was like initially. I think one memory I have was how green and lush it was. It was a monsoon, I think. I remember ditches filled with water as we watched from the train. But maybe it was. Maybe that's false. I find that difficult to recall. Certainly, it was hot. And when we went to Dilali Camp, we weren't there very long, and it was fairly boring. Distinctly boring, because there's nothing to do. There is a saying, there was a saying in India, do you suffer from Dulali Tap? Well, Dulali Tap is going slowly mad because of lack of anything to do in a totally boring environment. And people who are a bit odd, they say, oh, well, he's got a touch of Dulali Tap. And there we were, the sapper, I don't know what happened to the infantry, officers, what regiments? I think they were given a choice of various Indian regiments. We were given choice of three groups of sappers, because the Indian Army was founded on the old Presidency armies of the East India Company. There was the Bengal Army, the Bombay Army, and the Madras Army. As an interesting aside, it was only the Bengal Army that mutinied in 1857. They were from what was described as the martial races, the Punjabi Muslims, the Hindus from Oud, and so forth and so forth. Three of us decided we'd go for the Bengal Army because it sounded more dashing. The Madras Army, which was composed of Madrasis, which are Tamils, basically. Though the army had a good reputation, Madras had the reputation of being what was called the sloth belt, because nothing ever happened down in the south. All the action, and this is looking back, 50 or 100 years, but the reputation had continued that in the south it was so hot, people did nothing. It had been subdued since the time of Hyder Ali and Wellesley, so there'd be no action there. It was all up in the north where we fought the Sikhs. We took over the kingdom of Oud. We had activities against the Pathans and the Afghans and all the rest of it. All the action was in the north. So we thought we'd go for the north. So off we went to a place called Roorkee, which was the headquarters of the Bengal Sappers. King George V's Bengal Sappers and Miners, they were called. And there we started to train with Indian troops and to learn Urdu, in which I never became desperately proficient, but it was adequate, I suppose. And we did training with them. We did wet bridging on the canal. We did marches. We did dry bridging. We did tactics and so forth with them. And we lived in what was known as number two mess, which was number one mess was field officers, majors and above, and the other was captains and below, number two. And we had bungalows. I shared a bungalow with a chap named Robbie McKenzie, who unfortunately died a year ago. And we had a bearer to look after us, make the beds, do the various necessities. You were well treated there, because they would do things like they'd, in the evening when you changed, they'd have your shoes out. You'd come in, kick off your boots, put on shoes to go to the mess and so forth, and then have the socks turned inside out, laid on the bed, all ready to slip your feet into. That sort of standard of behaviour from the bearers. And then you paid the bearers, and you employed the bearers. So that was all right, but I must say I never liked it there. In fact, I thought it was pretty bloody.
What didn't you like about it?
I didn't like... What I didn't like was I lacked confidence of being able to... I think this is it. I lacked confidence of being able to deal with Indian troops in the same way I could deal with British troops. Through unfamiliarity, which would gradually wear off, and lack of a total command of the language, which of course was essential. It wasn't absolutely essential, because the Viceroy commissioned officers, the Jemadars and Subedars, would translate for you. But that's no way of carrying on. And I think I didn't like it there, basically through a lack of confidence that I could perform adequately.
Did the Indian troops have a different attitude or way of going on from British troops?
Oh, yes, enormously so. For example, they cooked separately, because so they didn't contaminate each other's food. You couldn't go into the lungos, that is the cookhouses, of the Hindus in case your shadow fell on the food and it would be contaminated. The Sikhs, they're the sort of Irish of India, you know, they're the butt of jokes, but they're splendid, stout-hearted, brave, commanding sort of chaps. They've only got one, at least they may have other, but unfortunately they're very prone to homosexuality. And you always find little boys in the background, which I found, and indeed still find, totally repugnant.
Is that what you found at Roquet?
Oh yes, oh yes. And as will appear in a moment, that was my only experience of the Indians there.
And the Muslim tribes?
They were fine. Actually, in fairness, they were all fine. They were a splendid lot of people. They were different. And in fact, although there are these Hindu-Muslim riots and Sikh-Muslim riots, there I was unaware of any friction inside the companies. And although one knew, in the lectures and so forth, one knew that this was inherent in India, was endemic in India. Inside the army, it didn't seem to exist at all. And certainly I would have nothing but high regard for the Indian troops that I came across. The Viceroy commissioned officers were absolutely first-class men. So that any shortcomings there, I was very conscious, was my own. As I say, not feeling confident to command these troops, principally, I think, through lack of language. Anyway, in due course, as we all did, we got posted to Camilla, which was in Assam, which was the base for 14th Army. My belief is that General Slim had his headquarters there, but as having then been promoted to lieutenant, got my second pip, I was still at the very bottom of the pecking order, so these things rather went over one's head, you know, when the higher formations, though was aware of what they were there and what they, more or less what they did, you felt very remote from them. But at Camilla, I was posted to an Indian company, the number of which I now forget, but it wasn't important because my posting was changed and I was sent to 2nd British Div, back to, somewhat to my relief, I must say, because I felt much more confident. An interesting thing in Camilla, I was in a mess there, and there was a chap who was in the same form as I was at school. I mean, considering the hundreds and thousands of people in India, it's odd that out of 30 boys, two could meet at that place at the same time. The thing I remember about Camilla was I'd left Roorkee unarmed. Now, this was quite wrong of them. They should have provided me with sidearms, pistol, and so forth, going up to an area there. And I was in the mess, complaining bitterly about this, because I imagined, as indeed was the case, it would be jolly difficult to get replacement arms when you're actually in the battle zone. You could get rifles and things, they seem to come, but sidearms not. And I remember having to buy a chap said, well, look, I've got a Smith & Wesson, I'll sell it to you. And I bought it from him and had it. It seemed a bit much to have to buy your own arms to go into the thing. I might have got one, but I might not. It didn't matter.
Whilst you were in India at this time, did you come across any civil
Civil disobedience, yes. Yes, I did. At a place called Hardwar, which was a Congress hotbed. We had to go up there with some troops. There had been riots. It was called Action in Aid of the Civil Power. That's what the phrase was. And you were... The army was brought in if the collector... The thing was run by... The areas were run by a chap known as the Collector Saab. And if he felt the situation was out beyond the control of the police, he'd bring the army in. But it had to be specifically under his control. You did what he said. And actually, all we did was stop rioters going into a certain part of Hardwar. That was my only experience of it. It was quite a short spell.
How did you stop them?
You put the troops across the road. And bear in mind, the troops were totally loyal to us. They didn't identify with Congress at all.
Was this the Bengal Sappers and Lions?
Yes, yes, from Roorkee. Hardwar was only about 15, 20 miles north. It was a hotbed of this Congress, what we call Congress Wallers. And you stop them quite simply. I mean, in the ultimate, of course, you'd shoot. But that was pretty ultimate. And interestingly enough, the instruction was, if you shot to kill. You didn't sort of... You picked out the leaders and shot them, which is a much more effective way, and in the end, less damaging way, than to sort of fire randomly over their heads and so forth, because it can only inflame the mob. Once they saw the leaders were shot, that was their lot. So you had a marksman out to say, righto, the chap there in the red puggri, and you gave the order. But I never had to do that. We were pretty well drilled in all this, too. The way we held in back when I was doing it was you had the line of troops across the road. Generally, the idea was to contain it and stop it running through the city. And you had the jawans, the soldiers, would hold their rifles with the butts on the ground. And they'd tap like this. They'd tap up and down with the butts of their rifles on the ground. And the rioters had bare feet. So as you advanced, you'd tap them on the toes. And this they didn't like, and they sort of drew back. And this was very effective. It may sound absurd, you know, now, but that was a very effective way of stopping them. I suppose if they'd rushed, you'd have had to do other things. But generally speaking, you could, if you were early enough, to try and defuse the situation.
So you weren't equipped with policing equipment like shields or...
No. Oh, absolutely not. Nothing at all like that. I'm not sure even if the police were. I think they were, but I'm not sure.
And why did they have to be stopped from going into that particular part of the town?
Probably looting or burning or... as it was a Congress area, attacking Muslims or something like that. That was beyond our comprehension as junior officers. We knew that the collector had required something to be done, and it was we did what he wanted.
Was the collector with you?
Oh, no. He was very remote. I dare say he was somewhere in the background, but I never saw him.
Was one of his underlings?
We were generally under the command of a field officer of our own who would take the instructions. I mean, bear in mind, as a subaltern...